Well, this morning is a completely different Sunday, and we're going to do some different things, and so I'm starting the sermon right now. So anybody else who arrives, now look around, anybody who arrives late after this point, they're going to miss out. So I'm going to start right now. Now, the last few weeks, as you guys know if you've been here, we have been working on these lesser-known characters of the Bible, and so we've looked at Nicodemus, and we've looked at Abigail, and Melchizedek, and Mephibosheth, and others. And so today what we're going to do is we're going to take a little bit of a license away from a single individual, and we're going to look at one guy plus a group of guys. The one guy's name is Asaph, and the group of guys is this kind of singing group-sounding name, Sons of Korah. So if you open up your Bibles to Psalm 73. Psalm 73. Psalm 73. Now, the book of Psalms obviously is this compilation of poems and songs that were used by Jews for worship, and some have called the book of Psalms the hymnal of the Jews from years ago. And I'm sure everybody has their favorites, but there's some psalms that kind of throughout the years have been kind of the well-known psalms. Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake." It's a wonderful psalm. It's one that so many have, you go to a funeral and they talk about Psalm 23. Maybe some of you have it hanging on your wall at home. It's just a psalm that has meant so much to Christians over the years. Psalm 100, "Make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all the earth. Enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise." At this time of year, you hear people talking about Psalm 100. Psalm 37, "Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart." So these and many others are psalms that the church and people who have followed the one true God have loved for literally 3,000 years. And we love them for lots of reasons. We love them because of the poetic nature. We love them because they direct our attention to God. We love them because there's meter and there's rhyme. But in some ways, we love the Psalms because there's personality. That there's something in there that just feels like it's not just a poem. It's like we feel our heart, we feel our soul in some of the words of the Psalms. And if I were to ask you, who wrote the book of Psalms? Many of you would say David, which would be partially true. David wrote at least 73 of the 150 Psalms, meaning that 73 identified David as the writer. But there are other writers that we find. We know that Solomon wrote one. We know that Moses wrote one. There are 50 Psalms that there's no identification, so we're not really sure who wrote that one. We know a guy named Ethan wrote one psalm. We know a guy named He-Man, who was the master of the universe. He wrote one psalm. So we have all of these authors of this old Jewish hymnal that's been used for literally 3,000 years in the synagogues and tabernacles and temple and churches, and they have different writers. Now, if you look at Psalm 73 that you have open in front of you there, I'm not going to read the psalm except the first four words. The first four words of Psalm 73 say, "A psalm of Asaph." Not a psalm of David or Moses or Solomon, but a psalm of Asaph. Now, if you begin to thumb through, 73 through 83 are all psalms that were written by this guy named Asaph. So you see 74, a maskil of Asaph. Maskil is a musical term. As you thumb through those, you find, like in Psalm 76 says, this is a psalm to be played with music, with stringed instruments. Psalm 77, it's a song to be sung in a choir. If you look at Psalm 83, it's a famous, what we call the imprecatory psalm, which is like call down curses on heaven from heaven. It says things like wipe them out and consume them and shame them and turn them into dung on the ground. We don't really read this one in church very often, but it's a great psalm. Well, this guy Asaph wrote 12 of the psalms that we have in the book of Psalms, 12 of them. But who was he? Who was this Asaph that God would preserve his lyrics, his poems, for all of eternity? Remember, the Word of God is going to last forever. So for all of eternity, this poet, this songwriter, his words have been and will be preserved for all time. But who is Asaph? Today we're going to work on that a little bit. But he's not the only strange author in here. Turn to chapter 44. Chapter 44. Psalm 44. And you get to Psalm 44. And again, those first few words, to the choir master, a maskil, this musical term, of the sons of Korah. And Sons of Korah kind of sounds like a musical group. And that's exactly what they were. But they wrote psalms. They wrote songs, verse 44, chapter 44, all the way through chapter 49. Some of them are called, this is a love song. This is a congregational song. So they wrote chapter 44 through 49, all written by the Sons of Korah, 84, 85, 87, 88. So they wrote 11 of the psalms that we have in our Bible, written by this strange-sounding Sons of Korah. But who were the Sons of Korah? And today we're going to work on finding that out. So what we're technically going to be talking about today, as you can see in my title up here, sing. That's what we're talking about today. And because Asaph and the Sons of Korah were directly in the epicenter of singing and congregational worship for the Jews. So the way we're going to begin right now is with a video. And during this video, we're going to have the ushers come up and we're going to take our offering. If you haven't brought your paper bag offering up, you can do it during this video. But what this video is a rendition of Psalm 77. And you can feel free to turn to Psalm 77, listen for the lyrics, listen for the song, but it is a modern day rendition of Psalm 77. And funny enough, Psalm 77, written by Asaph, this is sung by a modern musical group called the Sons of Korah. What, ironically, that's who we're talking about today. So for 3,000 years, the church and followers of the one true God have used the Psalms for worship. Every generation rewrites the music to those Psalms, and they sing them again. This is a modern-day version of Psalm 77 by the Sons of Korah. And again, we'll take the offering at this time and plastic bag. Listen to this really cool song by the Sons of Korah. So how Asaph and the Sons of Korah rose to prominence in the what we call the Guild of the Musicians in Israel is actually part of the story, I think, of why David had a heart that impressed God. And I love the part of David where you think about David the warrior, David the killer, David the commander out on the battlefield. And yet, there was also the David side that was a poet, that played the harp, that loved to sing. Sometimes we think that if you're a real man kind of guy, then you don't sing, you don't do poetry, you don't read lyrics, you don't love worship. But David actually flips that around and shows us what a real man looks like. But it was actually David that formalized this group, this guild of musicians and singers, and he gave them the task of leading the people every day in music and worship to God. Let me tell you the story of how it happened. And we're going to go all the way back in the story to the Ark of the Covenant, because the Ark of the Covenant, remember that holy box, you know, it has Aaron's rod, it has Ten Commandments, it has a jar of manna, but it represented the presence of God. And the Ark of the Covenant is kind of at the center of the story of how this guild of musicians arose to help the people in worship. And so the stories of Asaph and the story of the sons of Korah, or the Kohathites, actually merge together around the story of the Ark of the Covenant. So let me tell you a little bit of that story. And we begin at Mount Sinai. And if you remember on Mount Sinai, Moses received the Ten Commandments, but he also received instruction from God on exactly how he wanted the tabernacle built and how he wanted worship to happen. So you got to understand from the beginning that worship and congregational worship was designed by God. It was not devised by men. God designed what worship was supposed to look like and told Moses exactly how he wanted it to look. So after the tabernacle was built, and you got to follow along with the story, otherwise you miss the whole piece, but let me try to walk you through the story here a little bit. After the tabernacle was built, God designed that the sons of Levi would be those that cared for the physical part of the tabernacle. Now, if you remember, the tabernacle was built out in the wilderness. It had walls for the outer court. It had the Holy of Holies and all of the furniture and structure and posts and base and curtains that went along with the tabernacle. So from God's design, the three sons of Levi were the ones that were supposed to take care of the physical part of the tabernacle. His oldest son, Gershon, was responsible for things like the curtains, the large curtains that divided each of the sections. He cared for the coverings, these holy coverings. So that kind of think of maybe the fabric was what they were to care for. That's Gershon, the second son of Levi, a guy named Merari. The descendants of Merari cared for the frames, the bases, the posts, everything that was dealing with the structure that held up the curtains. It was their responsibility to care for the structural pieces. And the youngest son of Levi, a young man named Kohath, he cared for the sacred items within the tabernacle. So you think of like that big menorah, candelabra. Think of the furniture pieces, the altar, but specifically think of the Ark of the Covenant. It was their job to care for the Ark. Now, as the Israelites were out in the desert, they're wandering around for 40 years. I'm not going to go through that whole story. They went from Egypt to Canaan. But there were times that God said, it is time to move. And when it was time to move, everybody packed up all of their belongings, and they packed them all up, and they began to move. Well, as everybody else was packing their own belongings, these three sons of Levi and their descendants, they were taking care of the physical structure of the tabernacle. It was time to move, so they all jumped into their service. They packed up the bases, and they packed up the posts, and they packed up the curtains, and they got it all ready to move. And that's just how it went. Every time God said it's time to move, they had to do their job, get all their gear together, and load it all up. Now, this is where the story gets very fascinating, and sometimes because we don't know our history very well, we don't understand why it's so fascinating. So you have three sons, each with their own kind of category of care. For Gershon and Merari and their descendants, caring for the structure, the bases, the posts, the curtains, the coverings, when it was time to move, they loaded up all their stuff. They folded up the curtains. They loaded up the bases. They took all the posts, and they loaded them in carts. Think of carts, horse-drawn, oxen-drawn type carts. They loaded up everything in there, and it was time to move. But the Kohathites were not allowed by God to do that because they were caring for the sacred items. They were not allowed to touch with their hands any of those sacred items. Everything had to be wrapped in a very special way. Nothing could be touched. And when it was time to move, the descendants of the Kohathites had to physically carry those items, the menorahs, the altars, but specifically the Ark of the Covenant on the poles on the backs. That is what it meant to move. So if you remember the pillar of fire and the cloud by day, when that cloud lifted and they all knew, hey, it's time to go, everybody jumped into action, everybody loaded up everything on the carts, except the Kohathites, who loaded up everything on their shoulders, in their arms, or on poles, because they cared for the sacred items. Now, at this point of Israel's history, going to worship meant you went to the tabernacle to offer sacrifices. Because the tabernacle, especially where the Ark of the Covenant was, it was where God was. It was the presence of God. And we could talk about the Shekinah glory of God that came down and filled the tabernacle. So when they went to worship, what you would do is you would literally physically go to the tabernacle. You would draw close to the physical presence of God in the tabernacle. But at this point, music and singing was never, ever a part of going to worship. So in our minds, we can't separate music from worship, but in their minds, music had nothing to do with worship because worship was all about going to the temple. It was about drawing near to God. So after a while, with every time God said it was time to move and they had to, you know, tear up all the tents and the tabernacles and everything and move it and then set it all up again, the descendants of the Kohathites, they became very dissatisfied with the job that God gave them. And you can kind of see how it was for them. They looked around and, man, those sons of Gershon, they got to load their stuff up into the carts. And the sons of Merari, they got to load up all of their stuff in the carts and then they just got to walk. But all of the descendants of the Kohathites, they had to carry this stuff and load it here and walk miles and days with that stuff in their arms. And they began to get very dissatisfied. And they said, well, why do they get to use carts and we don't get to use carts? It's just not fair. So one of the descendants of Kohath is a young man, was a young man named Korah. And Korah became very dissatisfied that everybody else got to use carts. And why were they singled out and they only got to carry on their backs? And so he got together 250 other malcontents that were kind of sick of the way that things were going, sick of the leadership of Moses and Aaron. And they decided to stand up and say, this isn't fair. And we challenge Moses, you, and we challenge you, Aaron, for leadership. Now, this part of the story you know from Sunday school. Because there's this big rebellion, we call it the Korah's Rebellion, and they stand before God, and what do you want? And literally the ground opens up and swallows all 250 of these malcontents, and they are dead. And they are dead specifically, if I want to be specific with you, they are dead because they did not consider holy those things that God declared to be holy. That was the big issue. So never consider it to be no big deal when the holy things of God are profaned. It's never no big deal. And it applies to his name, to the Lord's table, to his book, to his people. Can I just say as your pastor, some of you need to consider what you are saying when you say, oh my God. What are you saying? And if it is true that when the holy things of God are profaned, he takes that seriously, what are you saying when you say OMG and you text it to your friend? Consider that. So back to the story, when the ground opens up and the offspring of Kohath and the family of Korah are swallowed up, evidently some of his sons were not a part of that rebellion. They lived on. And seven generations go by, and we hear nothing from the Kohathites, nothing from Korah and his family, until the seventh generation later, there is a descendant of Korah named Samuel that comes into the picture, and he was a descendant of Korah. And Samuel, of course, is the guy that anointed David. He's the guy that stood as God's mouthpiece. But after the death of Saul and the rise of David as king, Samuel dies. You remember that? We talked about that either last week or 2 weeks ago. David begins to realize that his people need some work when it comes to worship. At this point of the story, the tabernacle is not near Jerusalem. Most importantly, the Ark of the Covenant was just sitting in the warehouse of this guy named Obed-Edom. He was being blessed by the Lord. David decided that he needed to bring the Ark of the Covenant near Jerusalem to be the center of worship for the people. And this is where we first hear of music and musicians and singing as a part of the worship of God. Because as David brought that Ark of the Covenant from the house of Obed-Edom to Jerusalem, he assigned a marching band, that would be our words, marching band, musicians. He assigned this massive choir to walk ahead of the Ark, playing music, singing praises, as the Ark of the Covenant was moved from the house of Obed-Edom to its final resting place in the tabernacle just outside of Jerusalem. And there were singing, and there was dancing, and there was this great sense of praising the Lord, and he's here with us, and here he comes. And music was a part of how they expressed drawing near to God in worship. So it's at this point of the story then, the Ark of the Covenant comes into the tabernacle. David decides he's going to formalize the group of men and women whose job specifically was to lead the people in music, to lead them in singing with instrumentation and singing both sides, but specifically every day to lead them in worship. And this is the first time that worship, that word of worship, of praising and thanksgiving to God, is tied together with singing and music. And they're tied together as David decrees, this is how music is going to help us in our worship of God. And I want to show you a whole litany of passages that deal with this, beginning in 1 Chronicles 6. 1 Chronicles 6. And this is part of when David is formalizing this guild of musicians and singers to help the people draw near to the Lord in worship. 1 Chronicles chapter 6. Here's what it says in verse 31. 1 Chronicles 6, verse 31. It says, these are the men whom David put in charge of the service of song in the house of the Lord after the ark rested there. Remember, the temple hasn't been built. The temple was built by Solomon. This would be the tabernacle outside of, just outside of the city. Verse 32, they ministered with song before the tabernacle of the tent of meeting until Solomon built the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, and they performed their service according to their order. These are the men who served and their sons. Of the sons of the Kohathites, which would be the sons of Korah, here we have Heman, the master of the universe again, Heman, who is kind of the head singer, the head of the singing side for worship. Now, if you skip down to verse 39, and his brother Asaph, who stood on his right hand, namely Asaph, the son of these two guys, and they have this whole long genealogy. And verse 44, on their left hand were their other brothers, the sons of Merari, and you have Ethan, who have one of our psalms from this guy named Ethan. But this is the very first time that music was formalized as part of the worship of God. And it was David, the man after God's own heart, that kind of came up with the idea and formalized this guild. And at the head of the guild, he put specifically Asaph and the Kohathites, or the sons of Korah. And their job, their task, was specific. It was to lead the people in worship, to help them sing praises. And these guys then began to write. They wrote songs. David, we know, long before this time, he was already writing psalms. So Asaph begins to write psalms and songs. The sons of Korah write psalms and songs. Some of them were in charge of putting the music to the songs. Now, we don't have any of the music. We don't know what it sounded like 3,000 years ago. We don't have any of that, which is why constantly every generation remakes the psalms in modern tones. We don't have any of the original music, but these guys, they were putting the music together with the lyrics to sing songs of worship to help the people draw near to God. Let me show you a couple other passages. Go to chapter 25, 1 Chronicles chapter 25. The heading in chapter 25 says, David organizes the musicians, and it's a big, long chapter. But let me just read a couple verses here. Verse 1, David and the chiefs of the service also set apart for the service the sons of Asaph, and of Heman, and of Jeduthun, who prophesied with lyres, with harps, and with cymbals. The list of those who did the work and their duties was, and then you have this big long list of the sons of Asaph and the sons of Heman, the sons of Jeduth. If you go down to verse 6, we pick up the story a little bit more. They were all under the direction of their father in the music in the house of the Lord with cymbals and harps and lyres for the service of the house of God. Asaph, Jeduthun, Heman were under the order of the king. The number of them, along with their brothers, who were trained in singing to the Lord, all who were skillful, was 288. And they cast lots for their duties, small and great, teacher and pupil alike. So, David puts together the organization for those that were going to be a part of the music and the worship of God related to the tabernacle, related specifically to the presence of God. And he puts these guys in charge, among them Asaph, the sons of Korah, and others that were in charge. And their job was simply lead us in music, sing, write songs, write lyrics, write music, and help us sing these songs of praise and adoration and thanksgiving to God. For those that come to the tabernacle, help us do it well. And that's what their full-time job was. So how influential was Asaph in all of this? You know, we know David, and Asaph is one of these lesser-known guys. Let me show you two verses. First and Second Chronicles 29. So flip over one book, 2 Chronicles 29, verse 30. We fast forward in the story 300 years. So this is 300 years after the time of David. And we find a guy named Hezekiah, 2 Chronicles 30. Here's what it says. It says, and Hezekiah, again, this is 300 years later, and Hezekiah the king and the officials commanded the Levites to sing praises to the Lord with the words of David and of Asaph the seer. And they sang praises with gladness, and they bowed down and worshiped. So 300 years later, Hezekiah comes along and says, hey, we need to reestablish worship. We've lost this whole sense of singing these praises and adoring the Lord and the music and the singing. We've lost it all. What we need to do is go back to singing what David wrote and what Asaph wrote. 300 years later, they were still singing the songs of Asaph. 200 years go by, and we come to a very different part of the story. 200 years later, the destruction of the temple has happened. It's 586, the destruction of Solomon's temple. 70 years, the people go to Babylon. The place is, the Israel is desolate. After 70 years, they come back. They rebuild the walls, they rebuild their houses, but they rebuild the temple. And at the dedication of the temple, again, this is now 500 years after Asaph and the sons of Korah wrote psalms, wrote music, led the people in worship. 500 years later, we read, and I have it for you here, in Nehemiah 12:46, it says, for long ago in the days of David and Asaph, you have that one, Danny, could you put that verse up there? Long ago in the days of David and Asaph, there were directors of the singers, and there were songs of praise and thanksgiving to God. That's Nehemiah 12:46. 500 years later, they were still trying to figure out, how do we find people that could lead us in worship the way that David and Asaph did so long ago? So let's recap. In the design of the tabernacle, there was no, in the original design, no music. No music at all. Worship, going to worship, meant you went to the tabernacle to offer sacrifices. Specifically, though, in going to the tabernacle, you had the sense of, I'm going to offer sacrifices, but what I'm really doing is I'm drawing near to the physical presence of God. So worship meant drawing near to God, which is exactly the same thing we read in the New Testament in James 4:8. It says, draw near to God and he'll draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts. That's exactly what Jews thought worship was. It was going to the tabernacle, it was drawing near to God, it was singing his praises, receive this cleansing, this forgiveness of sins, and then to walk out with this sense of purification. That is exactly what worship was. You drew near, he cleansed, you walked away purified. So David, this unique warrior poet, comes along. He institutes song and music and lyrics, and he even, in Psalm 150, he gives us a list of potential instruments to use in worship. And it's a long list. Here's what it says. Use the trumpet, the lute, the harp, the tambourine, the dancing. The dancing. You got that? And for us, dancing is this. Strings, pipes. I like the last one because it says, use cymbals, even crashing cymbals. So if you don't like drums and cymbals up here, take it up with David when you get to heaven. It was his idea, all right? So singing, lyrics and music and instruments and words of thanksgiving and adoration to God, together in a crowd with other people doing the same thing, was how they expressed worship. And Asaph and the sons of Korah and other people were at the head of helping the Israelites do that well. That was their job. And every day in the temple, they would sing. There would be music going on. There would be people leading in song. And every day as people came for worship, they would have people there to lead them in song, in the worship of the one true God. And so it was David that helped link worship with music and singing. But the purpose was to help the people draw near to God, to give them this sense of, I am physically and spiritually in my soul, I am drawing near to God. So the music and the singing was an aid. It was something that was to help them do that well. 3,000 years later, here we stand in Nebraska. And the irony of still singing the songs of the sons of Korah and of Asaph should not be lost on us. You may not know it, but you know lots of those songs. We sing them in what we call hymns. We sing them in choruses. And so I asked our worship team to put together a medley of songs that all come from the song, the sons of Korah and Asaph, and the psalms that they wrote. And we're going to sing this medley of songs. So worship team, come back up. This medley of songs that we know, that are a part of our tradition, that come exactly from the book of Psalms and these songs that these men, Asaph and the sons of Korah, wrote. We still sing them 3,000 years later. Let's sing these together. So what do you think of the songs and the psalms of Asaph and the sons of Korah? You like them? Isn't it so amazing that 3,000 years after they wrote those, we are still singing them? And I just think that is amazing that, you know, even as we sing those songs here, how many other followers of Jesus over the last just 2,000 years in some rendition, in some form, have sung those same songs. I just love that idea. But what does this all mean now? What does it mean in the history and David and Asaph and the sons of Korah and the leading of God's people in music, in lyrics, in singing and song as a part of worship? Well, as we get to the New Testament, we find the same idea that God's people are singing people. We sing, we adore, we give thanksgiving. Sometimes we write poems. This is what God's people do when we express this idea of drawing near to God. Let me just show you two verses in the New Testament that we see this. The first, Ephesians 5:19, addressing one another in psalms, hymns, spiritual songs, singing and making melody to the Lord in your heart, giving thanks always and everything to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. And again, same idea, Colossians 3:16. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another in all wisdom, singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thanksgiving in our hearts to God. So the New Testament church replicates the intent of worship and what that worship meant and what it looked like even 3,000 years ago. And music helps us do that. It helps us draw near to God, and it helps us say things to God that sometimes we have a hard time saying. And it helps us say things to each other that sometimes we have a hard time expressing. That's what music does. So here's what I want to do with the rest of our time. I want to ask, why do we here sing what we sing? And then I want to talk about why we need everyone to sing every song every time. Both of these ideas come from the tradition started with David and Asaph and the sons of Korah. So first, why do we sing what we sing? Well, 99.9% of all the Sundays that you come to church here, we're going to sing somewhere between 2 to 5 songs, unless we do a really cool melody like this, then we'll sing more. We're going to have people up here on various instruments. We're going to have singers on the stage. We're going to have, you know, sometimes we'll do a cappella, sometimes we'll do it with music, sometimes we'll do it in different ways. But that's what we're going to do. And it is the desire of every single person up here on the stage and every person behind the scenes in the tech booth, everybody who is working on putting together these services, it is the desire of every single one of us that we as a church every Sunday have this sense in our souls that we are drawing near to God. Every single one of us wants that for our church. But of course, there are all kinds of peripheral issues. There are issues like, you know, how loud is the music? And how bright are the lights? Are they up? Are they down? Are they too bright, too not? The arrangement of the chairs evidently is a big deal. The arrangement of the songs. Do we sing it like they did in the 1800s, in the 1900s, or some new rendition of them? Should we stand up? Should we sit down? Should we raise our hands or should we not? Should we sing from those funny gray books, I think are called hymnals? I've not seen one in a long time, but should we sing from the screen? What if we need music to sing by? Oh, then we can harmonize and we can sing parts. Are the musicians up here, are they performing or are they leading? Should they be men and women or some mix or just men? Or all of these questions are peripheral issues to helping us have this sense of drawing near to God through music and singing and song every Sunday. Now, there's a lot of things that we could talk about. I don't have forever. But hear me very clearly say that every Sunday you come here, we want you to walk away feeling like I drew near to God. And there's a significant part of being able to do that that you have to realize who you are worshiping. We here worship Jesus. Good time for an amen. Who is my amener? James, right. I need an amen over here. Amen. Anybody over here? Anybody? Okay. Amen. Anybody who loves you, baby, today? Okay. Who loves you, baby? Okay. We worship Jesus. And the songs that we sing are intended to help us do that. To draw near, to be amazed, to feel like he's this great treasure that we'll never get tired of singing about. And the challenge that we have is both at the perception level and at the reality level. Let me talk about them. Some of you aren't going to like it. Listen along, okay? The reality is that when many of us were growing up, and if you grew up in the church, there were only about 100 songs that we ever sang. Maybe 100 is generous. But now, in modern times, there's about 100 new songs that come out every month. What do we do with all of these songs? So here's what happens. The older ones among us say, we need to sing more hymns. The younger among us say, we need to never sing another hymn again. Both of you are mistaken. Here's why. Technically speaking, a hymn is nothing more than a metered poem that is put to music and intended to be sung. And it's a really simplistic definition, but that definition includes lots of songs. And maybe you didn't know this, but the word hymn isn't a Christian term. All religions of the world sing hymns, not just us. And they sing hymns to false gods. They sing hymns to prominent people. And we kind of know this. We even sometimes sing about events, like the Battle Hymn of the Republic. It's about an event. So there's nothing overtly Christian about the word hymn. Now, what people mean when they say, let's sing the hymns, what you're really saying is, we want to sing those old songs we used to sing when we were growing up. That's what you mean. You don't mean all Christian hymns, because if you go to a Lutheran church, you pick up their hymnal, you're hardly going to know any of those hymns. You go to a Presbyterian church, everybody has different traditions. There are thousands and thousands of hymns. And you don't mean, let's sing a new one of those hymns every week. You mean, I want us to sing the songs that we used to sing when I was growing up. And that's what you mean. And if that's what you mean, then you have to realize at some level that what you mean is you want your preference. You want to sing what you like. It's a preference. And before the youngins go, see, it's a preference, see? Just like I said, it's a preference. Let me say that it is a preference for a very good reason. Because for some in here, blessed assurance, the old rugged cross, victory in Jesus. These songs you've been singing for 40 years, 50 years, 60 years. It's like your life and your blood and your spiritual formation, they're like wrapped up and intertwined in the lyrics and the music of those songs. Some of you remember sitting at like mom's funeral singing these songs. So they mean so much to you for very good reason. And I understand that. But for the older crowd who loves these hymns, you need to realize that the younger crowd does not have 40 years of history wrapped up in these songs. They don't have that blood and spiritual formation wrapped up in the lyrics and the melodies of the songs. But for them, In Christ Alone, written in 2001, when they were a teenager, it helped them walk dark days and days of temptation. That song means so much more to them than When I Survey the Wondrous Cross will ever mean to them. And where that leaves us then is, if we're going to be honest here with all the preferences and the differences and all the songs that are new all the time, we have got to respect different songs that people respond to very differently and have connection with in different ways. And we will disrespect either the older crowd or the younger crowd when we demand to sing songs that are really our preference. I want you to know, you are not the only person in this room. We laugh, but isn't it so easy to slip in there and say, okay, I'm not the only person in this room, but everyone should be a lot like me. They should like my songs and my preferences. So I want to say again that we're going to need to respect people at this level. And, you know, we're not going to go back to the, you know, piano and organ from 1985. We're not going to do it. But we're also not going to have smoke and whirly lights up here, because I don't want us to worship the place. I don't want us to worship the songs. I want us to worship Jesus. And for all of us, that's different. And how we do that is different. So can I just, as gently as I can, suggest this? If you are adamant that we sing more hymns, or you're adamant that we sing less hymns, or if you come every Sunday and you refuse to sing any song that doesn't fit into your category, can I just subtly suggest that maybe you are making worship about you and not about Jesus? And what we need is for us to understand and respect each other and not demand our own way in this. Now, for this to work well, for our congregational worship to work well, we not only need to choose songs, but we also need to all sing well, sing every song every time, and sing it enthusiastically, and sing it as unto the Lord in the sense of drawing near to God. That's what we need, and we need that every Sunday. And maybe you've heard people say, when I come to worship, it's just Jesus and me. And maybe you see them and they're, you know, their eyes are closed and they're kind of swaying back and forth. Or maybe you've heard somebody preach or say something about, you know, it's just you and Jesus in worship. The truth is, when we come together here as a church, it's not about you and Jesus in worship. It's about you and me and Jesus in worship. It's about us and Jesus together. That's part of the congregational singing that we are a part of. And what I mean by that is when you sing congregationally, you guys are helping these guys draw near to God. And you guys are helping these guys draw near to God, which means that if you don't sing, you're not helping anybody. Not singing, and again, I'm putting it out there. I almost wore the shirt with a target right here, but I guess it should be on my back. You are being selfish when you don't sing because you are saying it's about me. You're not helping anybody else draw near to God. And it's, you know, what I love about that idea is I've had this sense in my life that sometimes people feel like, you know, if I'm not up on stage and I can't play like Aline, or I can't sing up here like all of our singers and play the drums, and if I can't do any of that, you know, where's my place? But I think the sense of congregational music and singing means that all of us are a part of the choir every Sunday. And we need everyone to be a part of that choir every Sunday. And before you go, have you ever heard me sing? You need to know that no one dangles lower on the talent tree in music than I do. No one. All right? So if I can belt it out, so can you. Don't use that as an excuse. That's a simple rationalization that makes it about you. So generally, I would say that if you come here on a Sunday, or maybe I would say Sunday after Sunday, and you are not singing, it means that you are not worshiping. And I know there's times that maybe you don't know the song, and there's times that, you know, it's been a long week and you're caught up in the emotion of it, and you know, those are all true. But if week after week you come and you don't sing, what you are doing is you are hurting the rest of us. You're hurting us because you're not helping us draw near to God, to have the sense that we are walking into His presence. You're not helping. And we need you to engage. We need you to help for His sake. But I need you to help for my sake. And they need you to help for their sake. I mean, if we're going to make this church all about every one of us individually, it's never going to work. We have a responsibility to each other to sing for the glory of God and the good of everyone else. And when we don't, at some level, we're making it about us. I have lots more I want to say. But let me just end, and then we're going to sing. And I'm going to listen. I'm going to stand here and watch. And I have my phone. I'm going to take pictures. I have been in churches with terrible music on the stage, but fabulous singing in the pew. And I've been in churches with professional. Like, I've been in Nashville for worship. Can you imagine being in Nashville at a church and you got to be up on the stage worshiping? I mean, imagine that. And I've been in churches where the music is fabulous and not a single person is singing. In a lot of ways, I don't care what happens up here musically. I want us to sing. Do you know that we do not have a reputation in this community as being a singing church? We have got to change that. We've got to change the fundamental culture of who we are during our singing time. And again, there's hundreds of issues, and we're tweaking lights and sound and all kinds of stuff to try to help us. We need you to sing enthusiastically for the glory of God and the good of everyone else. We need you to do it every week. Now, I'm going to have the band come back up or whoever's singing this last part. Don't be gun shy. Don't say, you know, listen, can I just tell you, if you're a bad singer and you're afraid people are going to hear you, sit in the front row. Why do I sit in the front row every Sunday? Nobody can hear me, right? I love the part that what impressed God about David's heart was in part the stirring of worship that was there, his desire to do this. And for him to take Asaph and say, hey, your full-time job from this point on is to help people. And the sons of Korah, your full-time job is just to help the people. Shows us a little bit about what impresses God.